November the 24th, 1943. My diary. Up very early to contact our gun position. Reception strength 9, but the OP strength only 1. I'll try and put up a very long aerial. Files diary. Officer from the 17th Battery arrives to pass on shoot for Major Jenkins. Nice chap. We had an affable day. The aerial. This was a metal interslotting series of metal poles with a cross-shaped antenna at the top. Its maximum height was 20 feet. We contacted Ernie Hart at the command post. Any mail up, Ernie? Over?
Yes, yes, over.
Any for me or files? Over?
Hold on, over.
We wait, during which time he makes inquiries.
Yes, yes, there's something bothering you. Over?
Great. Any news about leave? Over?
No, nothing. There's a rumour about 48 hours in Naples.
Can you tell Edgington that the mist is on the Swanicles? Over?
The what? Over?
The mist is on the Swanicles. Over.
What's it mean? Over?
He'll understand. Over and out. The pattern of the day is only broken by rushes to do a slash and cook the lunch. We keep our bit of fire area dry by laying a gas cape over it. We make tea about every 2 hours. Doing a pony is difficult and entails getting a rain-ridden bum. Of course, our leader, Churchill, he's not kipping in the back of a truck. No, he and his crony Roosevelt are in sunny Cairo, and, as it's Thanksgiving Day, he's got Roosevelt carving great lumps of turkey at his villa. And so stoned does the old man get that after the scoff, they put the gramophone on and the Prime Minister of England dances with Mr. Wilson. What's happening to the war, you say? So, Churchill is foxtrotting in Cairo, Milligan is kipping in the mud of Italy. Game, set and match to Churchill, I'd say. On the 8th Army Front, the 78th Division and the Indian 8th Division have attacked and got across the Sangro. God knows how they did it in this weather. Perhaps, that's it, perhaps they had umbrellas. The evening comes in dark and gloomy. Alf boils up a couple of tins of stew. Sitting up in bed, we eat it and small talk. He tells me his missus has sent him a Conway and Stewart pen. A Conway and Stewart pen. I clutch the bedclothes with excitement. He shows me the latest photo of his wife, Lily, and their two kids. I clutch the bedclothes with excitement. Now then, on the morrow, we would try and extend the aerial. Yes, that's it. We would try and extend the aerial. Meantime, next day. I'll try and put it up this tree, Alf, I said, with good intentions. You should look good in a tree. I always thought in your paybook where it says place of birth, it should say tree. Hold this aerial, Alf, I said, and I will climb up and insult you from a great height. The words rang clear on the morning air. Also clear in the morning air was my lone scream as I fell 10 feet. Are you all right, said Files with a whimsical smile. Of course, don't you know, falling 10 feet from a tree is always all right. Clutching and swearing, twigs snapping around me, I managed to get up to the lower branches again and let out a tarzan call. Oh! Pass me up the aerial, Alf, says Milligan. It would appear I've climbed too high for him to reach me. You'll have to come down a bit, he says. The tree is wintergreen and slippery. In various contortions that are only done by men with strychnine poisoning, I get to a lower level and give another tarzan cry. Oh! Here! Grab hold, says Files, holding up the aerial. I firmly grab one of the windmill's antenna. It snaps off. Never mind, there's still 3 more, he said cheerfully. I try and haul the thing through a complex of leaves and boughs. Now, a 20-foot-long pole is no manoeuvrable item. It was like trying to thread a giant darning needle, and I wasn't trained for that. I gave another tarzan call. Oh! It got to the stage where I was trapped between the branches and the aerial. Shall I chop the tree down, said Files, giggling. It's the antenna, I said. That's in the way. I'll unscrew them. I soon had 3 loose antenna in one hand, and I find the other hand insufficient to climb and hold the aerial. Cat, I said, and dropped the antenna. Looking up, Files loses his balance and starts to slide back down the muddy slope. So smooth is his progress that he doesn't realize he's moving. gently, the back of his nut collides with the tree. I gave a tarsen call, and a lot of bloody good it did. Oh! The antenna are now slopped in the mud. I, in contrast, am covered in green moss and scratches. This is all called modern wireless communication. Look, shall I come up and help, said Files. No, I don't need help. I am the complete wireless technician. To prove it, I gave another tarsen call. A wet officer from 17 Battery appears at the bottom of the tree. He explains to Files that he is to pass on a shoot for Major Jenkins. Files explained that this is not possible until the aerial is up. The officer can hear swearing issuing from the tree behind him, because Milligan has ripped the knee of his battle dress. It's letting in the cold mountain air, something his London-bred knee's not accustomed to. The officer is Lieutenant Pascoe, young, slim, very refined. He could hear a very unrefined voice from behind the tree saying, "Fuck all this! If it doesn't work this bloody time, I'm packing it in!" I have managed to tie the aerial to the top of the tree. Throw the antenna up, Alf! Using Olympic-style javelin throws, Alf manages to hit me on the chest. Can you tell the man up the tree that the chute has to go through at 14:30 hours, said Lieutenant Pascoe politely. File shouts out the message. Milligan is unaware of the officer's presence and replies thus, "They'll be fucking lucky!" I give one more tarsen call. Oh! On descending, I was confronted by a smiling Lieutenant Pascoe. Did you leave Jane out there, he said. Oh, ha, ha, ha. Hello, sir, I said. We're having trouble with the aerial. Yes, I heard you having the trouble, he said. We immediately tried the strength of the new aerial. It's no better. As it is, a prearranged chute with no adjustment of range goes through on Morse. The target laid on the rear of the crest of Limata Grande. Oh, what's so important about that? I asked Lieutenant Pascoe. Nothing. It's a registration chute for future reference. With that, he demands tea. Yes, sir, we said, and demanded cigarettes. He gave us one each. Tea concluded, he took his leave, wandering off left towards where his transport was hidden. We hear a "Hello!" from further down the slope. Was this the spirit of Arcadia? There, amid the greenery, we see a clutch of muddy gunners in various stages of climbing. They are Bombardier Sid Price and his merry ration carriers. "Come down here," he calls. "Why?" "Because we can't get up there." "Ah, if we come down there, where you can't get up from, we'll be all down there as well, not able to get back up here where we are now." "It's your bloody rations. Take them or we leave them here." That's a desperate situation. Alf and I slither down the hillside. Rations are rations, and we'll do anything to get them. Along with them, we find two bloody great batteries for the wireless set. We manage to get the rations up, but the weight of the batteries is too much, so we leave the things on the mountain. Sid Price puffs his pipe as he and his porters slither backwards down the mountain. "Oi, listen! When are we going to be relieved?" I ask as a parting question. "Use a tree," he calls. We are alone again in our little heaven in the clouds. A small group of silent infantrymen are leaving their position. They pass in silence. We, for our point, have had a bellyful of wireless. Let's pack it in, I said. As a matter of fact, I feel a bit feverish. So I bed down and Files prepares an evening meal. I had fallen asleep before he served it. He didn't bother to wake me. Thursday, November the 25th, 1943. Alf Files' diary. Still up here on the hill, but rather enjoying it. My diary. Feel better this morning. Colossal downpour of rain. Everything damp and soggy. Especially me. I awoke to the roar of rain on the canvas roof. 6 o'clock. What's the matter with me? It's this army habit of early. It was catching, and now I had been affected. It will take years of post-war training in bed to get back to normal. I make the morning tea and awake Files, who is lying on his back, sucking in air through his open mouth. A great sight. He opens his bloodshot eyes for 10 seconds. The brain doesn't register. I hold up his chipped mug with the steaming tea. A soppy grin spreads across his face, and the clutching hand takes the tea. Oh, good luck, he says, and sips it, and screams as he burns his tongue. So, what'll we do today, he said. Nothing. Well, that's all we've bloody all done since we've been here. Yes, it's a cereal, I said. We roll up the back flap of the truck and sit looking out at the rain-drenched mountainside, which gradually disappears in the mist of the downpour. I haven't heard a sound this morning, said Files. He peers round the back of the truck. He liked a good peer. He's checking his patent water catchment. This is a hole with a piece of canvas placed in it. It's full, he said triumphantly. It seemed lunatic to be catching water in weather like this, but we need it to wash in, saving our jerry cans of clean water for drinking. Silently, a dripping soldier appears. 17 battery, he announced. We've come to relieve you. He pointed down the mountainside to a truck on its side. We can't get any further up, he said. Did you put chains on? No, he said. It's bad enough we're in battle rest. It took us 2 hours to get the truck that far. Look, it's impossible for us to get our truck down, and you can't get up, so it's pointless you staying here. He nodded and agreed. Four Bugger collects his belongings from his truck and disappears down the hill with the driver. That night, out of sheer boredom, I read my army paybook. Interesting, said Files. Incredible, I said. I was born in a tree, it says here. We off for the light and lie back smoking in the dark. The rain continues. Fancy, right now, Churchill will be sipping brandy, smoking a cigar, and dancing with a Mr. Wilson, the swine. November the 26th, 1943. It was like a spring morning. I don't believe it, said Files. The sun! It changed everything. Colours once brown were now green, green, green. Today I would shave. Today I would organise my life anew. No more slobbed in bed all day. Today I would do things. What those things were, I did not yet know, but it would be things. And the first thing would be breakfast. I built a fire, and soon the bacon was sizzling. The smell is wafting through the morning air. A string of mules accompanied by Cypriot attendants come from the left and pass slowly by. They are a little amused, seeing us in nothing but socks, boots and shirts. Files is shaving. Isn't it marvellous what the sun will do, he says. He whistles in between strokes of the blade. For me, I will do the shave thing after the breakfast thing. And after that thing, I'm going to have a look over the hill thing, at Jerry's positions thing, I declared. I'm beginning to wonder how long we'll be up here, said Files. It's been 4 days now. We were only supposed to be here for 24 hours. Someone in the valley below is trying to attract our attention with a mirror. I wonder what they want. We better switch the set on, said Files. We get through and the message is,
come in! Your position is being closed down. Over.
We take our time. I stroll to the top of the mountain ridge for the last look. A marvellous view meets the eye. 1,000 feet below us is the great Garigliano Plain, with snow-mottled Aranchi Mountains on the far side of the river. To the left is the Gulf of Gaeta. In the distance, at the curling point of the bay, is Gaeta itself. Even as I watch, a great plume from an explosion starts skywards. Jerry is carrying out demolitions. Why can't I get a fun job like that? The last of the infantry are leaving their foxhole and wearily making their way back down the mountain. The lines move forward, says the tired-looking corporal in answer to my question. Here, we've never seen many of them smiling or laughing, reflected Files.
Well, they got bugger all to laugh at. I mean, what do you say? Cheer up, Charlie, we're being mortared.
Oh, Cor, talk about a laugh. We were shelled all night and 10 of us were killed.
Boom!
Another explosion at Gaeta. There won't be much of the bloody place left, said Files.
Boom!
Christ, they've got it in for that place. I wish we had some binoculars, said Files. Why can't you hear without them, I said.
Oh, what a lovely sight. Spitfires with American markings. So, there was something of ours that they were using. Usually it was us borrowing from them. They fly in threes at about 10,000 feet, then suddenly go into a dive towards the foothills across the Garigliano. Soon they are shrouded in flak. We hear the Spitz cannons going, and then they shoot straight up from the dive, alternately turning left and right from their target and then coming in for a second run. They repeat this three times, then turn away and race back for our lines, climbing as they do. We just sit and watch it, as though it were at the Palladium. Uncle, we shout, bravo, bravo! File starts back to the truck. Come on, Milligan. We don't want to get stuck here in the dark. While we were up here on this hill, there had been excitement in the valley. The officers' mess had caught fire. We couldn't stop laughing. Officers off duty were in bed when the conflagration started. They were seen in their pajamas hurling buckets of water, filled by their batman, of course, and Major Looney Jenkins was seen to rush in and from the smoke and flame hurl his possessions to safety, where Gunner Pills, who hated him, was seen to throw them all back in again. What remained of Jenkins' kit was a sorry incinerated mess. His appearance on parade next morning was a joy to behold, in a charred hat, smoke-blackened battle dress, and his right arm in a sling from Burns. He had the gall to enter in part two orders, Engine in Action. I remember I penned an ode to this occasion in the style of the late William McGonigal. I didn't preserve it, but it went something like this. Oh, it was in the month of November, in 1943, that the officers' mess caught fire. Oh, dearie, dearie me. And into that terrible fire, Major Jenkins did rush in to save his precious possessions, his wig, his teeth, his gin. But as he threw his treasures out, Gunner Pills committed a sin, for as fast as the Major threw them out, he threw them all back in. On parade next morning, our name from the roll call to check, Major Jenkins appeared, a charred and tattered wreck. And if only he had stayed inside and been burnt to a cinder, he'd have given us all a laugh, much bigger than Tommy Trinder. Whistling merrily, we packed all our gear and prepared the descent. The ground was like grease. Files drives down at about 1 mile an hour, engaging four-wheel drive. I had to walk ahead and scout out the least dangerous bits. Gradually, the gradient became more acute. The truck starts to slide down with gathering momentum. All I could think of saying was, "Goodbye, Alf, I'll tell the missus." Alf doesn't want to die. He remembers an old bus driver's trick. He puts the truck into reverse, and the counteraction of the wheels slows the vehicle up, and it gradually comes to a halt. He looks out the cab and grins. "Oh, bloody hell, I want more money for this job," he says. "That was brilliant, Files. Brilliant, do you hear me, Files? Brilliant. I won't let that go unnoticed. You see, by tomorrow morning you'll be on the honours list and an extra egg for breakfast, a present from a grateful nation. God bless you, young Alf. You and your see-through underwear. England isn't finished yet." "It's finished." I looked at my watch. "Tomorrow." Together we gradually slither down the hill and with perfect timing arrive at Bombardier Dean's as he's making coffee. "It's the men from the hills," announces Nash. "Yes, we bring good tidings. Jerry is blowing up Gaeta." Files had raced up to the battery office and returned with mail. "You always get more than anyone else, Milligan." "Well, you unimaginative buggers, you write to one bird, I write to 10. You're paying the penalty for monogamy." I'm drinking Dean's coffee and luxuriating in my letters. Ah, romance. "Darling, I love you, dearest, my darling. Darling, Terry, darling, darling, I love you, darling." "Good luck to them all," I say. Alf is depressed. One of his kids is ill with scarlet fever. Fancy being a child in this war. Shortages, fathers away, might get killed, bombs, and scarlet fever on top of that. "They're only going to give us 48 hours leave in Naples." Jam Jar Griffin comes in with the news. There's a stunned silence. "Did you hear that?" repeats Jam Jar, removing his tin hat, leaving the lining on his head. "Leave," he starts to spell it out. "Leave, L-E-A, all right, we heard," I said. Me and my friends are in a temporary state of shock. We are not used to such announcements. "Naples," said Dean, looking up ecstatically. Files isn't enthusiastic. 48 hours? That's no bloody good. It'll take us half a day there and half a day back. All we get is an afternoon and a morning. What can you do in that time?" "I should imagine if you have the right addresses and you're quick, you could get in 10 shags, 3 litres of vino and a ton of spaghetti," said Nash. "Shags?" Jam Jar has a look of horror on his face. "Don't you know Naples is the most syphilitic city in Italy? That's nothing. We'll make it the most syphilitic city in the world, said Nash with a sweep of his hand. Pavilius Albion, said Jamjar. Vitreous China, I replied. Look, we're going to look a bloody scrappy lot. We need a change of clean clothing. Clothing, O Mox? We need a complete change of body. I smell like the inside of a guardsman's sock. So that I'll be nice and fresh for the journey, I've been put on command post duty from 2:30 in the morning till 5:30. Lieutenant Stuart Pride is on duty. No, no, he's not. He's got malaria. I peer into the officer's billet. I hope you feel better soon, sir. He looks up from his camp bed. Thank you, Milligan. And so saying, downs half a bottle of whiskey. He looks terrible and is sweating like a pig. Whiskey. They all admitted that it was this fiery Scots anaesthetic that made them try for a commission. I get my head down early. At the dreaded hour of 2:25 3/4, Alf Files wake me up. Spike! Ah! Ah! What's that? What's that? Your turn! He stands over me, pulls the blankets off. Oh, dear. You'll go blind, he says. In the command post, Lieutenant Budden is talking to Bombardier Edwards. The night is quiet. Only 36 rounds of harassing fire. I doze my back to the wall, sitting on a box. Towards dawn, I fall off the box. The phone buzzes. Command post, I say. It's the 8th Survey Regiment, or rather, one of them. They give me a message that is all gibberish. I write down a string of figures and hand them to Lieutenant Budden. I suppose this must be something to someone, I said. Budden takes the message, screws up his eyes. They appear to have a left-hand thread. Ah, at last, Deans, the meteor. He handed the message to him. Deans takes it. Ah, yes, he says. From it, they start doing sums and drawing lines with protractors and set squares. I return to the dozing, and I return to falling off the box a second time. This way I pass the long hours till dawn. It's now Saturday, November the 27th. I have to alert the cooks, so I take my mug. Gently I wake May, for he is a cook, and therefore God. I help him find his boots and assist him to his feet, all the while saying, Ronnie May is a prince among men, for his is the truth and the light, and he walks in the ways of wisdom. You want some fucking tea, don't you? He said. Ah, the master can even read the human mind. I stick around and he starts at the feed oven by throwing a lighted match into the drip feed tunnel. Whoosh, it ignites. Food, bloody food, that's all this lot think of. All I am is a total slave to the intestines of this lot. How can a public schoolboy like me, with a future in the jewellery business, end up stirring porridge in World War II? He moans merrily as he places dishes of food over the fire. He unrolls the bacon from their gold-tinted compote tins and slops them into the dixie. I get the first breakfast of the day. G-Tuck is silent with the sleeping files, Nash and Deans. The camp is stirring. Odd guns bark around in the morning area. Naples. Naples, Naples. I must try and make myself respectable. I have a good shave in hot water and wash my hair. The removal of that dirt leaves me light-headed, and I have to sit down. God knows what will happen when I have a bath. Could mean a wheelchair. Basenji. Did it really mean a non-barking dog? The three tunnels are warming up. We're all getting aboard. It's 80 miles to Naples, but on these roads it would appear to be 200. By 9 o'clock we're all packed in the back, waiting. By 9:30 we're still all packed in the back, waiting. Impatient swearing is emerging from the passengers. It gradually swells into a roar, and then the chorus of, Why are we waiting? Waiting, fucking waiting, why oh why are we waiting? The ting was always under my musical direction. We all hit the last word, ting, waiting. The word reverberates around the gun position. Cries from those left behind of, take the bastards away. The lorry suddenly lurches forward. A great jeering cheer comes from the passengers, and it continues as we jerk and slither down the country roads. Our king is sending us to Naples to get the SIF, cries Smudger Smith. Hooray! Comes the mob's reply. It was a dreary, nightmare journey along worn, muddy secondary roads in transport that was also secondary. In turn, we also looked like secondary troop. But it all fitted. Saturday, November the 27th, 1943. At midday, we arrive at Naples,
We pulled into the Piazza Dante, clogged with vehicles and people. Italians are screaming at each other. Some are screaming at the walls. Some are screaming at themselves. The city pulsated with life. Some drunks were pulsating with death. The pavements were crammed with pedestrians who overflowed onto the street. Allied soldiers, civilians, all jostled together. There was that peculiar smell of Italian cigarettes permeating the air. As we jumped from the truck, several pretty girls are touting for restaurants. "Nice of food and wine," said one ravishing little beauty. As bait, she handed us a plate of fish cakes. "Oh, delicious." "Molto buono," I said. We followed her to a side street into a trattoria. "This bloody menu's in Italian," moaned Wenham. We've put away a mountain of spaghetti. Some set about it with knife and fork. "This isn't a meal, it's a bloody puzzle," said Wenham. "You're supposed to swallow it along," I said. "Or unless of my guts." "How do the art eyes manage to eat this day after day?" said Griffin. "Like I told you, with a fork." Alf Files has his head back at 45 degrees. It was something to do with the wine glass he was draining. "Ah, lovely stuff." "Be forewarned, all you lung locking bars," said Deans. "There's pox of galore up there. One good screw and your prick will swell up like a manor and your balls will drop off." "Now, why doesn't Thomas Cook put that in his brochures? All that see lovely Naples and Sorrento, cities of love and music crap. He should be saying, round trip to Naples and back to an old English syphilis ward, £67 return." We window shopped. Such luxury goods. Silk shirts, stockings, watches, suits, shoes. "I'll come back home. We got bleeding cardboard boots and suits made of gunny section in our shops, and the Idaho's got all this stuff," said Files. "Ah, but we have better tanks, airplanes and guns," I said with a cheerful inane grin. Files is looking at a magnificent lady's kimono. "What's setter pura mean?" "It means," I said, "pure setter." It was stockings and knickers. That seemed to be the main purchase. Thousands of parcels were sent in transit to wives and girlfriends, and some boyfriends. The basic reason was the sexual thrill the squaddy felt in buying them, and waiting for the inevitable letter saying, "When you come home, you can put them on for me." Alas, by the time they got home, some bloody American had already taken them off. I bought a leather cigarette case for my leather cigarettes. It was real hide, and I bore in mind that if boiled, Kijil would eat it. Files buys a silk bedstead, hairpins, and guess what? Silk stockings! We repaired to the Mecca of the British Army, the Army and Navy Club. This one-time universal store is now adapted as a naffy and staffed by pretty girls who are being worn away by staring soldiers. Files' diary. Wow. Lounge, music with Italian trio, cakes, sandwiches, hot dinners, tea, and silk stockings. All at reasonable prices, everywhere an air of elite comfort. What a naffy. So elite comfort. Blokes in crumpled battle dresses with their boots up on the table, cheeks bulging with donuts and the jam dribbling down their chin. There are some ugly girls serving. A red-faced, sex-starved infantryman is looking at one and saying ecstatically, "Caw, look at her, she's lovely." There is a time for ugly women, and World War II was one of them. I have seen desperate soldiers, as handsome as Greek gods, escorting women who looked like Arthur Mullard in drag. We ensconced ourselves in the lounge and listened to the Italian trio. The violin leader was a thin, febrile male, circa 72, deep-set eyes. There appeared like two holes drilled in his head, with someone from behind looking through. Another old man with a bald head and a curly white moustache, or was it a curly head and a bald moustache, played piano. A huge stomach forced him away from the keyboard. He had to play arms outstretched. One more dinner and he'd never make it. On drums is a gorgeous Italian girl with shoulder-length raven black hair. They were grinding their way through a selection of, shall we say, touristic melodies, including Pistol Packing Mama, In the Mood, and it was all totally unbearable. "I suppose," I said, "he thinks he's Glenn Miller." "He sounds more like fucking Max Miller," said Files. Jamdar Griffin and Spike Deans are approaching. They're excited. They've been buying silk stockings. It's late afternoon.
We've had tea, and we go and visit the Duomo. This was an interesting vaulted shopping arcade, high enough for pigeons to fly within. It's in a cruciform shape, and after 4 hours walking around, so were we. In a moment of petroleum-induced madness, we all piled into a dying Fiat taxi. The driver could barely see over the bonnet. We thought he was standing in a hole in the floor and propelling the vehicle on foot. A quick drive around town, then he dumped us back at the Piazza Dante. There was a terrible argument over the fare. Who was going to pay it? Inside every Christian, there's a Jew shouting to get out. "We better get to the billet before it gets dark," said Dean to his being mother. The billet was on the dock front. We knew when we got to it, it was the only building standing. 5th Army British Contingent Transit Camp. All intakes report to the guard commander. We hawked our stuff off the truck and presented ourselves at the guard room. "Yes, who is it?" said an officious, chubby, red-faced, total idiot RE sergeant. If he was in Germany, Italy would make him a Gauleiter, said Willem. A Gauleiter? He couldn't even make a fucking cigarette lighter, said Jamjaw. Words didn't count here. We produced our 48-hour passes. The sweaty sergeant took them all, walked to the window and squinted at them. It took 3 minutes to digest each one. "They're all the same, Sarge," I said kindly. "No, they're not," he snapped. "Numbers and names are whole different." Oh, shit. He then proceeded to laboriously enter our names into a book. He wheezed as he almost etched our details on the paper. "Who's senior here?" he said. "You are," I replied. I'm senior NCO with this party," interjected Deans. "You be responsible then," said the shit. "Responsible what, Sarge? Never mind what. You're responsible, understand?" "Yes, Sergeant," said Deans crisply. "Party, shun!" We did nothing. On the right, number 612, 1901, 2¾, we said. "Party, quick, march!" We all hibble-dobble out of step from the room before the startled gaze of the shit. A large warehouse with beds. "Aye," said a dopey room orderly. "We've not been open long. Your first thought be that today." "What time's dinner?" we chorused. "Oh, 7 o'clock till 8. We tried the dinner from 7 to 8. It was bloody terrible. "Are you going out after this?" said Jamzer. "I don't think so," said Fars. "I'm shagged out walking." "No, I'm shagged out eating that bloody food," said Griffin. "I think I'll have an early night." "Yes," I said. "Why don't you all try on your silk stockings?" The dopey room orderly is putting blackouts up at the windows. One miserable yellow bulb cast a depressing gloom around the room. We were all in bed when the air raid warning goes. We'll all sit up. What are we supposed to do?" said Wenham. "Well, you're supposed to be frightened," I said. "Quick, put your silk stockings on." There was no sounds of planes, so I fell asleep, not knowing or caring. Tomorrow, I must buy some silk stockings.